Hello, I'm Matt Matem, Deputy Editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
Hello. And this week, we're going to be rating Game to Screen Adventure, the Super Mario Brothers movie, found footage sci-fi at Lola, French coming of age at Falcon Lake, and family romp, The Portable Door. But before we get onto those, what we start with every week, what have you been watching this week, Jordan?
I have been doing a bit of an A24 double bill this week because I've been watching Beef on Netflix, which is the series starring Steven Yeun and Ali Wong. It is about a pair of people who are involved in a road race incident, which spirals drastically out of control. And I just thought this was tremendous. It's out today as you're listening to this, and I'd say it's very much worth watching. Steven Yeun in particular is exceptional. There is an episode where he absolutely split my heart in two. And I'm a big fan of Ali Wong. I don't know if you know this about me, Matt, but I generally hate stand-up.
I vaguely know that about you, yes, from sort of brief discussions we've had in the past.
and she is one of two stand-ups in existence who I actually enjoy watching. So I was really excited to see her. And she, it's more of a dramatic role for her. She's not doing the kind of hyperactive screaming persona that she does on stage. It's a lot more sort of low-key. And I thought she was really great as well. But it's a really interesting show. It's very like complex and nuanced in the way that it portrays these two characters, because they start off as these very sort of furiously angry archetypes. And then because it's a 10 episode show, you get to really dive into who they are and why they are the way they are. And I just thought it was really smart and nuanced and emotional and very sympathetic. And, you know, I can absolutely see why, you know, the creator of this show, Lee Sung-jin, he got snapped up by Marvel to rewrite The Thunderbolts. And of course, Steven Yeun was recently cast in that film as well. And I can absolutely see why that has happened after watching this show, because, yeah, it's a really great piece of work. And the other thing I've been watching, the other half of my A24 double bill, is I saw Beau Is Afraid, which is the new film from Ari Aster, who, of course, previously directed Hereditary and Midsommar, two of the greatest, dare I say, horror films of the last 10 years. I can't say too much about his new one because reviews are currently embargoed, but I can sort of hint at what I think, what I put on Twitter, which is that the first hour of this film stressed me out in a way that I haven't been stressed out in the cinema since Uncut Gems. Really just intensely stressful. And there is a sex scene in it, which is easily one of the funniest things you'll see on screen this year. Just absolutely hilarious. So those two things I can hint at, but you'll have to wait till I think next week is when the review embargo drops. So that's when everyone's thoughts all around the world will come out on this film.
Yeah, I can't wait to see this. It's 3 hours long, isn't it, as well? So you had to carve out a lot of time for it.
I think we're allowed to say that. Yeah, it's 2 hours, 59 minutes to be exact. So it's a beefy watch. No pun intended. It's the latest in like a run of extremely long films, isn't it?
Yeah.
We've had Babylon, Avatar, John Wick, and now Beau Is Afraid are all pushing or over the 3 hour mark. It feels like a while since we've had a run of films like this that have been quite this long.
It's definitely a trend of the year for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. What have you been watching, Matt?
Besides the films we're going to discuss this week, I actually haven't really been watching that much this week, partly because I had an immensely stressful interview situation last night, which I won't go into too much detail, but I was kind of caught on the hop with an interview, like a very important interview, and had to do it in very sort of awkward circumstances. But all was well that ended well, but it was a very, very stressful experience. And I was extremely wired afterwards and just couldn't go to sleep till about 2 a.m. last night. I feel like I've got like a sort of interview hangover almost from it, but there we go. But what I have been watching is, we've just been absolutely inundated with trailers this week. Obviously, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. I mean, of course, we're just immensely looking forward to it anyway, but I thought that trailer just looked great. I'm just so excited for that.
Cheeky little MCU reference in there as well. I was quite surprised by. Yeah. Do you think there's a chance we might actually see Tom Holland pop up in one of these films?
Well, the thing is, they've kind of got to outdo the last one, which everyone loved so much, haven't they? So I feel like they are going to just throw everything at it, and they've got to have something in there that's going to feel kind of surprising, haven't they? So I sort of wouldn't rule anything out. So there was Asteroid City, Wes Anderson's kind of sci-fi sort of one, which again just looks extremely Wes Anderson, ridiculous cast, sort of amazing color palette and compositions. Very funny trailer. I often find with Wes Anderson's films, that I really look forward to them. I really enjoy the first half an hour and then I just kind of run out of steam with them. That's happened with the last few, really. So
right.
I'm hoping this won't go down that route. But I mean, for the time being, I'm very excited about it.
I'm excited to see Tom Hanks in a Wes Anderson movie. It's nice when he adds new people into his regular players, you know, because you want to see how they fit into the toy box. You know how Jason Schwartzman is going to be. You know how Adrian Brody is going to be, all the Wes Anderson regulars. But yeah, how is Hanks going to fit in? That'll be quite exciting to see.
Yeah, he does feel like he'll fit in well.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed the Extraction 2 trailer as well, which...
Cool trailer, yeah.
Yeah. So I had slightly mixed feelings over Extraction 1, but I thought this one, it felt like it was leaning into just being just so over the top in terms mm-hmm. of action and, you know, his arm catching on fire and him punching someone out. And then
it's like you got an upgrade, a flame upgrade to his forearm.
And then you get like another sort of glimpse of this, another action scene where he's kind of on a train or something and he's got this massive sort of gun.
A minigun.
I felt it looked very video gamey in a good way. Maybe that's just me. And then,
I mean, it does that thing where, yeah, definitely the scene on top of the train, the scene in the sort of prison yard really reminded me of the prison fight at the start of the raid 2, where you just have Rama being just absolutely swarmed by everyone. That seemed like it was definitely a touchstone and influence. But I like the way the camera sort of mounted to the front of him, sort of Requiem for a Dream style, where you're just really focusing on his face as all this is going on. It really puts you in the middle of the chaos. I think it was probably a smart move to really isolate that scene and put it out there as a trailer.
Yes. Because
I'm super enticed by this film now. I'm very much up for it. The return of Tyler Rake, the best named action hero out there.
Yeah, what a name. Yeah, then there's obviously the Barbie trailer as well. I mean, that got almost slightly overwhelmed by the poster meme that was sort of going around and was kind of enjoyable, sort of even within a matter of hours, it had almost been done to death, really. But the sort of poster reveal was just quite amazing in terms of the cast they've got for the film, you know. Mm-hmm.
There were just lots of people I didn't even realize were in it. And like, I'm generally on top of all this stuff. I was like, oh, what? That person's in it? That person's in it? It was pretty insane. I sort of enjoyed all the taglines for it as well.
Yes.
Like, it seems like they're having a lot of fun with it. If you haven't seen these posters yet, the idea is all the pictures of the Barbies, the sort of taglines are, she's the president, she's a doctor, she's a scientist, all these kind of things. And then all the Kens are just like, he's a Ken, he's another Ken, he's just another Ken. So I guess the idea is theoretically going to be that, you know, men get to thrive on basically doing nothing and the women have to be at the top of their field to even get noticed.
Yes, that looks very fun and enjoyable. And I'm also sort of embarrassed to say I haven't even had time to catch up on my sort of two essential shows that I'm following at the moment. I don't know if you have, which are Succession and The Mandalorian. I'm sort of behind on both those. Have you seen this week's episodes yet?
I'm bang up to date on Succession. I will never miss an episode of Succession, the best show on TV. A little bit inside baseball, but we record this on a Wednesday, so it's currently Wednesday morning. Mm. So I haven't had time to watch the latest episode of The Mandalorian yet, but I will watch it tonight, I think. Mm. So I should have watched it by the time this goes out. But yeah, Succession, I think, is still firing on all cylinders. It's still just absolutely tremendous. Just no show has one-liners like Succession does. The characters are just so well-rounded. They just are an absolute mastery of that world now. The Mandalorian, I'm really wavering on this season, I have to say.
I was just about to say this and was going to wonder if I would be speaking out of turn, but yeah, I really, really just haven't felt like, I don't know what it is, but I just haven't felt hugely sort of compelled to keep watching it, basically. I kind of will do just because of how much I've invested into it so far. And it's not like I think the episodes so far have been sort of terrible, but I can't put a finger on what's missing, but I'm just not really, I don't really know where it's going. I don't really feel sort of that I'm being sort of pulled along by it, or that I'm sort of, each episode finishes and I kind of almost think, yeah, what sort of happened there? Like, doesn't sort of leave me thinking, like, whereas, you know, Succession, whatever, you finish and you're like, I need to see this next episode. But I thought the first one was just straight out of the gate, just what you kind of expect and want and hope for, like not walked down at all for the final season, not sort of going slow in a build up to a finale, just getting kind of straight in there. With The Mandalorian, I've just haven't felt hugely compelled to sort of keep catching up on it on time, really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're comparing and contrasting the two, the part of the reason why Succession is working so well this season so far is it feels like they're building towards something. There is like a real momentum towards an end point. Whereas with The Mandalorian, like, you really had sort of the pinnacle of Din Djarin and Grogu's story at the climax of season two. That was sort of the natural way to end that story. And now they're sort of continuing it, but not, because it's not really a story about Din Djarin and Grogu anymore. Like, I feel like I'm just not getting anywhere near enough time with those two characters. Grogu really hasn't had a significant plot beat all season, really, which is kind of mad given the popularity of that character. And they're really leaning into the, you know, the Filoni-verse of Star Wars in the sense that, you know, they've obviously brought Bo-Katan into it. They're bringing the Mandalorians back. They seem to be heading back to Mandalore. That's very much part of the animated universe canon from the Clone Wars and Rebels. And those are two shows that I sort of had dalliances with, but didn't fully engage with them in the way that I probably should have. So I'm not quite as engaged when those plot beats become more prominent in the show. And then they're trying very odd different things as well. Like, I think one of the previous episodes had that whole sort of 30-minute section with Dr. Pershing, the kind of minor character from season one, who is now like, he's turned good. He's been absorbed into the New Republic. And I guess that's sort of setting up what happens with the sequel trilogy, sort of. Is that going to be explaining how Palpatine returns in those films or something? Like, I just really don't get where they're going with some of these storylines. It's very odd, particularly given that everyone loves Grogu, everyone loves Din Djarin. Why don't you just focus on those two characters?
Bizarre. So we'll see how things progress as it goes along. And then perhaps we'll check back in at the end of the season and see how we're finding it.
Yeah.
But let's get started, shall we, on the films we're actually reviewing this week. So, thumbs at the ready for this.
It's me, Mario!
We will destroy the Mushroom Kingdom!
Bowser is coming.
I'm not afraid. I'll do anything for my brother.
We're going to save him.
Yes! Fire!
You asked for it! This is fun!
Here we go!
That was, of course, the Super Mario Brothers movie. Before we get into what we thought about the movie, let's hear from Princess Peach herself, Anya Taylor-Joy, who I spoke to recently about the film. I started off by asking her whether Princess Peach was a role that suited her.
I think we're all looking for characters that are more 3D and have more going on for them. And I think, again, Illumination, Nintendo, the directors have done such a good job of creating a world that still feels inclusive of those who have loved the game from the beginning. And yet it's fresh, it's new. And if you're not somebody that knows the games very well, you can still have an access to it.
And Chris Pratt and Charlie Day the other day, they were kind of saying that it's actually Luigi who kind of occupies the sort of damsel role more than anyone in this film, isn't it? So is that what you thought as well?
Yes, but I also think that that's part of the messaging of the film, which is, you know, Mario and Luigi have such a beautiful relationship that's never quite been explored in this way. And what I see as a takeaway from the film is, no matter your differences, if you work together, you're probably going to achieve your goal, and it's easier than doing it by yourself. And so I think seeing all these characters in a slightly different light, it hopefully makes the world a little bit brighter.
And did you get to work with Chris and Charlie and Jack Black at all?
No, I wish. If we ever get the chance to do it again, I would love to do it like that, because they're so talented and I feel like I could learn so much. But I did get to meet Jack for publicity and I fully fangirled. And that does not happen to me very often at all. I just lost it because, I mean, he's like a hero. He invited me to a Tenacious D concert and I was like, okay, I can die happy.
Would you consider playing Princess Peach in a live action version of this if it ever came up?
Yeah, that sounds like fun. I would love to. Listen, she's the best. I love Peach.
And to hear our entire Anya Taylor-Joy interview, download last week's Inside Total Film podcast. And she also gives us a little insight into Fury Road prequel Furiosa too. So it's well worth a listen. Now, Jordan, before we give our verdict, can you start by just setting up what this film is all about, please?
Yeah, you could say, let's go. That was a terrible Mario impression. Yeah, so this is the animated adaptation of the beloved Nintendo video game series from Illumination Entertainment of Minions, Despicable Me, Sing, and The Secret Life of Pets fame. And I would say, if you go into this expecting an Illumination movie rather than a film that lives up to the trailblazing, critically adored games, you'll have a much better time. So this starts in Brooklyn, where Mario and Luigi are starting their own plumbing business, and they're hoping to pull off a job that puts their name on the map, essentially. There is a sort of flooding incident in downtown Brooklyn, which is ultimately of little consequence. But in the process of trying to solve this flood, they discover a green pipe underneath the city, which will look very familiar to anyone with a passing knowledge of the games, because it is a warp pipe. And Mario and Luigi are sucked into a whole new world en route in this kind of Bifrost-style warp transport bridge. The brothers are split up, and while Mario ends up in the vibrant Mushroom Kingdom, scaredy cat Luigi finds himself in the Darklands, where he's captured by Bowser, who is the, of course, nemesis of Mario in the games, a big kind of turtle lizard dragon thing who breathes fire. Bowser has recently acquired a superstar, which he intends to use to conquer and rule over the world, essentially. So to stop him and get his brother back, Mario teams up with Princess Peach, the ruler of the Mushroom Kingdom, and their plan being to recruit the Kong army to take the fight to Bowser. The first thing to say about this is that this is a drastically more faithful rendering of the video games on the screen compared to the notorious 1993 movie, which, although it has its fans, I think Matt Matum, chief among them, is widely considered to be, you know, the absolute nadir for video game adaptations. Just a terrible, terrible movie all around. This film, Nintendo were very closely involved in the making of it. Mario creator Shigeru Miyamoto, he's a producer on the film. A lot of the iconography will be instantly familiar. The cartoony visuals feel of a piece with the games compared to the live action film, where really none of that iconography was present. Particularly, you know, the more recent sort of 3D entries, where this at times feels like a movie version of those games. It shares a very close art style with things like Mario Odyssey and Super Mario Galaxy. The Mario games, however, not particularly known for their storytelling now. And that's where really the film has to step up and a lot of the reimagining comes in. So you have Princess Peach, for example, who has traditionally been a damsel in distress for much of the Mario series. You know, the first game famously has the end of level title cards where it says, you know, the princess is in another castle and you have to go and find Peach in another castle. So she's constantly being searched for. There are exceptions where Peach is a playable character, but here she really is the one with authority. She's the one with the ideas. She's the one driving the story forward. And Mario is along to help Peach, essentially. And I thought that worked really well. And I thought it was a good way to reposition those characters in a way that didn't feel hopelessly outdated. And it sort of makes sense that Luigi is the damsel character in this scenario because he is the scaredy cat. He is the sort of helpless one. And they have a lot of fun with the Bowser character as well in a way that I really enjoyed, because he's a character who's always been obsessed with Peach ever since that first game, constantly kidnapping her. Later games have set up that he has this sort of desire to marry her, which again is incorporated into this film. And that sort of softer side of Bowser is very much present in the film as well. And, you know, there are things in this film that I really enjoyed. There's a terrific Mario Kart sequence, which is, you know, sort of ripped straight from the game. And it's just pure chaos with dozens of racers on the Rainbow Road flinging shells, anti-gravity inversions, vehicles blowing up. It's almost like the directors watched Fury Road and went, let's put that into a Mario movie, essentially. Like, it really is absolute chaos with these giant cars and, you know, spikes on the vehicles and all this kind of stuff. I would say I was never bored, exactly, because the film really doesn't give you the opportunity for your attention to waver. It's 91 minutes long, which is, you know, fairly brief, including the credits. And the pace is just relentlessly frenetic. That's absolutely fine. This is an animated movie aimed at kids primarily. But for me, I think the storytelling would have benefited from a few more breathers and a few moments where it felt like we could have developed these characters a little better. We could have established the relationships a little better. When Mario first meets Peach, it's like immediately they're just like, all right, let's do this. There's no kind of setup to that relationship at all. It's just like, there's just no time. They're just not interested in that. It's really just like the momentum is the most important thing here. Overall, I enjoyed it. I wouldn't say it blew me away, but I wouldn't say it's a complete disaster like that the first adaptation was either.
Yeah, I'm on a very similar pace to you. Yeah. And with that first 93 adaptation, it's just one of those things that was like a childhood film that I loved it when I was a kid and had all the action figures and stuff like that. even though I watched it a few years ago, and I just couldn't believe how weird it was. I don't know what I was getting out of it as a kid, but I think I just had no sort of discernment then. But it was obviously so weird, so unlike the games. And then this, like you say, is the other extreme where it's so like the games. And I'm not a massive gamer, but like Nintendo and Mario was something I kind of grew up with. I haven't really sort of played the very most recent games. The last console I got up to was a Wii, just a standard Wii. And Super Mario Galaxy. So that was probably the last one I played. But I'm familiar with the iconography, the music and everything, the things that pop up and you're like, oh yeah, you know, that's something from the Mario world. I felt similar to you in that, like, I haven't really looked at them closely because I try to avoid reviews before reviewing something myself, like here, so I don't get kind of unduly influenced by anyone else. But I was surprised that I saw surprisingly negative reviews, because I thought, similar to you, that it was good fun. It was completely sort of passable for the time, some enjoyable elements in there without it ever becoming a great film or more than, you know, what I would kind of qualify as like a 3-star film. But I wouldn't say it was like, you know, a worthless, you know, like 1-star, one of those things that you're going to be absolutely tortured if you have to take children to go and see it, for example. And I wouldn't say it definitely skews quite young. It's not one of those to convert any older people. Especially if you don't really have any kind of affection for the game, or if you don't have children to take with you, I would say it's not one of those animated films that, you know, is all ages and just you know, just a great standalone film. I thought it was perfectly fine. And yeah, like you say, the characters are really, really underdeveloped. Like Mario just doesn't really have a character at all, really. But he's a kind of brave guy who sort of doesn't give up, but that's literally his own sort of characteristic. And all the relationships between the characters are quite thinly sketched. Like we get this little hint of like the brotherly love between Mario and Luigi, but I feel like it's not really quite enough. It never quite gets to anything like a kind of tear-jerking level. I also thought, although they don't really go into the romance side of things, I thought like they were just an odd couple in that Mario looks about 40 and she could pass for like 18, you know. Wonder how that will develop if they make future films, because it feels like this is just going to absolutely steamroll the box office over the Easter holidays. I just can't really see anything competing with it.
Nice. Yeah, it's going to absolutely dominate. Yeah. We should talk about the voice cast a little.
Yes.
Because obviously there was, I would say, a fair bit of confusion and consternation about the voice cast when it was initially announced, because it is one of the more sort of insane voice casts in recent animated movie history. Chief among them being Chris Pratt, who plays Mario, of course. Pratt, not an Italian-American, which seemed to be the part of the basis for the disappointment that he was cast in that role. But, you know, you've also got people like Anya Taylor-Joy in there as Peach, Charlie Day as Luigi, Jack Black as Bowser, Seth Rogen as Donkey Kong, Keegan-Michael Key as Toad. Truly sort of crazy voice cast. For the most part, though, I thought the vocal performances were just absolutely fine, like perfectly decent, perfectly respectable. Other than Keegan-Michael Key, who I thought was actually doing a pretty distinct voice from his own, and I wouldn't have pegged that was him if I didn't know in advance. They all have that quality where you can tell exactly who the actors are at all times, which isn't great because, you know, it frequently pulls you out of the film for that reason. I mean, the biggest one being Seth Rogen, who is just Seth Rogen as Donkey Kong. And he even does like the Seth Rogen laugh, like on a couple of occasions. And you're just like, this is not my Donkey Kong. Like, what is going on? But when he was talking, I thought he was absolutely fine. And there is quite kind of a fun relationship between Donkey Kong and Mario in this film, in that they initially meet in a sort of gladiatorial arena in combat. And then after that, they just sort of hate each other and they're constantly sniping at each other and trying to one-up each other. So I did sort of enjoy that relationship. And I ultimately thought Jack Black was actually pretty good casting as Bowser. Yeah. He can turn up like the sort of sinister side of that character when he wants to. But then because he has this softer side, like he can tap into that more gentle quality that Jack Black has as well. And I don't know if we want to go into spoilers, but the film does utilize his musical abilities as well in a way that I quite enjoyed.
100%, yeah.
What did you think of Pratt?
I have to say, I actually thought he was perfectly fine, and
yeah,
almost I would go as far as to say good, to be honest. I don't know what the general consensus is, again, like I say, because I haven't read the reviews yet, but I just don't think you could have had the Charles Martinet voice, who obviously voiced the character in the games, throughout a whole film, because obviously it's fine in a game when he just pops up with the odd little catchphrase, but you just, yeah, it just couldn't have lasted for the film. So I actually just thought it was completely fine. Yeah, so it worked for me, really, to be honest. And then same for Charlie Day as Luigi as well. I thought they worked in those roles, really. I was completely fine with that, and thought it was a decision that I thought made sense, really, after seeing the film. So I didn't have any problem with that. I suppose there's obviously the question of cultural appropriation. They do have an extremely stereotypical family as well.
Mario's dad, voiced by John DiMaggio of Futurama Bender fame.
Oh, wow, yeah. But I thought, considering it's such a broad world and so cartoony, I personally didn't take any offence to any of that, because it's just, yeah, that they don't really look human at all, like Mario's kind of proportions and his face. I mean, they look exactly like they do in the game.
Yeah, it's very weird. They almost look like, I don't know, it's very hard to describe, because it's supposed to be the real world that they're in initially. Like, it's supposed to be our world, so it's strange that they're such misshapen sort of people. Like, isn't really like touched on or explained in any way. But, you know, it is what it is. I sort of went with it. I mean, speaking of the sort of audio side of things, I did think there was a very strange dependence on licensed music in this 100%, film 100%.
Yeah, that was another of my sort of criticisms I had jotted down, that they have these few kind of needle drops that are just one, they're just extremely obvious, just stuff that have been used in films so many times,
very inappropriate sometimes, yeah, as well. Like the first one you get is Battle Without Honor or Humanity from the Kill Bill soundtrack, which is, you know, popularized by Quentin Tarantino, which, you know, which kid is going to get that? Yeah. Like, that's got to be one for the adults, surely.
Yeah. And then you get Mr. Blue Sky at one point as well, and Holding Out for a Hero, which, yeah, you know, we've already had in another film just this year alone.
AC/DC, the Beastie Boys. You get like all sorts of just, you just get some, yeah, just insane needle drop choices, which I found particularly baffling, because, you know, the Mario music is just iconic. And when Brian Tyler's orchestrations of those classic Koji Kondo Mario themes are used in the film, they are just absolutely gorgeous, and they really push all those nostalgia buttons in a way that I was like grinning. I just loved hearing that stuff, like played by full orchestras and utilized in the way that it's utilized in this film. I was just slightly disheartened whenever they would just randomly drop some classic track in for seemingly no reason, when you've got this absolute treasure trove of incredible music to draw from.
I thought it was odd as well that, because they had committed so much to basically being, let's make this as much like the games as possible, let's basically just recreate the game world, so having that them sort of blasting in from the outside just didn't really feel like it fitted at all. I thought that was a really odd decision.
Yeah, but you would absolutely never get anything like that in the games. The closest you had to that in the games was a recent level in Super Mario Odyssey, the most recent 3D game, where you get a kind of song in the middle of one of the levels, which is heavily like memed and quite beloved. So it feels odd that they would just draw from licensed tracks for this. Yeah, I'll also say that there is just an insane number of Easter eggs in this film. Appropriate that it's releasing for the Easter weekend in that sense. But like, truly, I don't think I've seen a film with this many references to its source material in there before. Because it's not just like visual gags and character cameos. I mean, like practically every sound effect in this film has been lifted from the games in some way. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary, the sheer like saturation level that they've achieved in terms of the Mario world. Like, you really feel like you're enveloped in a kind of love for those games.
Yeah, because I mean, like I say, because of not having played the most recent games, I probably missed some of those. But even, yeah, for me, there was a lot of stuff I recognised. And that was sort of one of the problems for me. And I suppose it is really difficult when it is a film like this, especially when you're coming after, you know, a film that went so wildly off-piste all those years ago, and sort of people wanting a more faithful one. But it literally just felt like it was an assemblage of things from the game. So the story was kind of so slight that it was literally just, how can we kind of get from this bit that was in the games to this bit to, as you say, can we throw in a bit of a Mario Kart bit? Can we throw in a bit of a Donkey Kong bit just to get to the next step? I couldn't really shake that feeling that they had just assembled the bits of the Mario games that they wanted for this film. I mean, and there's still plenty of stuff left for the sort of, you know, I would say inevitable sequels. But that's kind of how it felt to me. And I went along with it because it did push some nostalgia buttons for me. And like I say, I thought it was fun. There were some funny moments. But again, for that thing, if you're not a kid or if you're not someone who grew up with the games, so much of it just doesn't make sense. Like the powers that they get, you know, in the Mushroom Kingdom from the mushrooms and the other sort of items that Mario can pick up, they just don't really make any sense. And within the world, there's no explanation as to why one hit takes the power away, which just obviously makes perfect sense playing a platform game, but isn't kind of explained away in the world of the film at all, you know. And then they obviously stage these action scenes to kind of get them as much like the jumping on the different platforms, dodging the plants and things like that, while still it kind of, you know, being a film like action sequence, but just can't really escape those. It feels like it's on rails, really, to me. That's what it felt like. It just couldn't deviate at all. And I mean, maybe certain fans would have been upset if they did take a bit more license with it.
Yeah, there are a couple of moments where the screen literally goes side on and you get a proper like platforming sequence that you would get in the old 2D games, which is, I mean, it's pretty cool as someone who loves Mario and loves those games to see that on screen. But I can sort of understand why, if you're watching it, you might feel like you're being sold a product rather than told a story, you know. But, you know, for the most part, this worked for me. I'm a big fan of the game, so I was just pleased to see it sort of done some sort of justice on screen compared to what we got 30 years ago, you know. And while it's not Pixar, you know, they're not trying to tell a particularly deep story here. It's just a fairly fun, breezy romp that doesn't do anything drastically wrong for my money, but neither does it exceed any sort of expectations you might have in that sense. So sort of perfect Easter viewing, really.
And it's one of those films I'll no doubt be going to see it with my 5-year-old. And I don't kind of dread the thought of seeing it again. I feel like I'm quite happy to watch it again. So that to me is a sort of positive sign.
Yeah. We'll also say stick around till after the credits.
There's two credit scenes here. I would say the last one, I mean, it was fun. Again, fun for me, but it's not like, it doesn't introduce anything that you haven't had kind of hinted at during the film. Yeah, it doesn't introduce anything completely new,
just sets up where they might be going with a second one, which is, as previously discussed, surely inevitable because this is going to do absolute mega business at the box office.
So that was the Super Mario Brothers movie, which is in cinemas now as you listen to this. And so from one tech world to another now, it's this.
Your sister is her mysterious invention, Lola.
Lola is a system of electrical processes which allows us to observe forecasts from the future.
This is magnificent, it's beautiful. It's going to change history.
This is the true magic.
Movies, royal weddings, a musical rebellion, signals beamed around the world.
Because of this pioneering work,
this marks a huge turning point in the war against Nazi Germany.
That was Lola. Jordan, please set Lola up for us.
So this is directed and co-written by Andrew Leger, and it's a found footage film, the premise being that in 2021, a sort of fully edited film is discovered in a house in Sussex. The footage dates back to 1941, has been captured by sisters Thomasina and Martha. We discover that Thomasina has invented a machine, which she dubs Lola, which has the ability to intercept signals, like radio signals from the future, which is she's able to then view on this rudimentary sort of television screen. Initially, their future explorations are cultural. They discover David Bowie, The Kinks, Stanley Kubrick, you know, decades before these people will all become artistic giants. But of course, you know, in the late 30s and early 40s, we were at war with Germany, and the pair see through Lola the full extent of the horrors sort of to come with the Blitz, and they decide to intervene with a pirate radio broadcast warning the citizens of the UK of London where the Blitz bombings are due to happen that night, giving people the sort of chance to evacuate. Despite their best efforts to sort of cover their tracks to for their antics to remain secret. They're eventually found by British intelligence, who soon realize that, you know, Lola is a real deal. This machine can actually see into the future and could be an invaluable asset for the war effort. But if you know anything about time travel movies, you'll know that even the smallest change can have drastic consequences in the future. And even if they're saving lives in the short term, Lola, the miraculous machine that it is, has the potential to drastically alter the course of history, and not for the better.
So that was Lola. Did you actually enjoy this film?
Yeah, I thought this was a really interesting film, actually. It really reminded me of films like Primer or Safety Not Guaranteed, in the sense that it's a lo-fi, micro-budget time travel film with these really big ideas and enough vision to pull them off, despite the fact that they, you know, clearly often don't have the means. What I found really interesting is that Leger and his team, they've used kind of doctored archival footage like World War II era newsreels to actually tell the story, alongside material that they shot with old school cameras like a Bolex or a Newman Sinclair. So you genuinely can't tell sometimes where the newsreel footage from actual newsreel footage from the 1940s ends and the footage shot in the present day begins. I thought that was a really, really smart way to tell a time travel film. You essentially get so much bang for your buck because you're using existing material and you're working around it. I thought that was so smart and just really creative, especially for a film made on what is clearly, you know, a very small budget, just such an effective form of time travel. It is literally time travel. We're seeing into the past. It suffers from that problem that all found footage and all time travel movies do, in that there are several occasions where you think, why or how are they filming this? Especially, you know, in the 1940s when cameras were frigging massive and noisy. Like, no one's sneaking around with a, you know, a tiny camera to sneak stealth footage. There is like this sort of in-universe explanation where Thomasina, she's supposed to be this brilliant inventor who is great with quantum mechanics and all these things that have allowed her to invent Lola, where she sort of goes, oh yeah, I invented this camera, like it's way smaller than existing cameras, and it allows me to put it in a bag or whatever. There are some sops to the format. And of course, because it's time travel, it suffers from the questions of time travel logic, particularly as they don't really set out the rules in Back to the Future fashion. You just kind of have to go along with it and work out how things work in this world. So there are a few moments where I was thinking, would that happen? Like, could you not have prevented this terrible thing happening by doing something else because you have a machine that can see into the future? But they're sort of minor quibbles, really. I thought this was really creative, really sort of original. I don't think I've ever seen a film quite like this before. And for the most part, I thought it was achieved pretty successfully.
I have to say again, I know it's boring to keep saying this, but I'm on the same page as you here as well, in that sometimes I just find that, like, yeah, when there's films like this that you can sense it's low budget, you can sense it's a bit lo-fi, so for some people that will be a bit of a turn off, just, you know, that they won't be able to get over. But I find something kind of, yeah, like thrilling when you can just get a feel for the sort of invention and economy, you know, that people are using to make something like this. Yeah, it just was a really sort of fun idea. I liked the I just liked the design of it, the sort of the aesthetic of this Lola machine, you know, that's just this big mechanical sort of, you know,
it's a bit like a Tesla machine or something. Yeah, like that. It's a real like early 20th century mechanical wonder, basically electrical. Yeah, mechanical wonder.
I like the fact that, again, obviously it stretches logic, but there is something kind of believable about, you know, it's not so fanciful, that because they are just receiving transmissions, you kind of feel, oh yeah, that feels like that would be,
yeah, yeah. Seems feasible, doesn't it? Yeah.
And they obviously ask these moral questions about, you know, what's the right thing to do, and, you know, sort of certain sacrifices for the greater good and that kind of thing. In some ways, again, you could ask moral questions about the sort of, you know, the doctrine of the footage and sort of treating the war in this way. But I thought it was, yeah, just really, really interesting, really nicely done. A nice kind of twist on found footage. Yeah, just some sort of interesting ideas, some nice kind of scenes in there. There's this really nice musical moment where they kind of basically do an old-timey cover of You Really Got Me by the Kinks, you know, and it's kind of a bit, again, back to the future-esque there.
Comes this sort of motto for, like, victory in the war effort, doesn't it? Like, this real morale booster. Like, it's quite, yeah, it's quite fun.
I'm always happy for a bit of Bowie to be shoved into any film. I'll always take that. And there's a few, it's definitely one of those films that will leave you with a few little, like, interesting sort of talking points, you know, of like what would happen, you know, if you did this, and what's the cost of this, and that kind of thing. So it was, yeah, just a really, really enjoyable, inventive little film.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, really, really well worth seeking out. Like, you know, it's a very small film, so don't go in expecting the great new thing. But I would say it's very, again, a very breezy film. Mario was 91 minutes. This is like an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, you get real bang for your buck with these films, given the short amount of time that they're on screen for.
You really do, yeah. So that was Lola, and that's out in cinemas on Friday, if you fancy checking that out. And now, time to jump into this.
Quel âge, là, Basset?
J'ai 13 ans, mais j'ai bientôt 14.
C'est vrai qu'il y avait un fantôme ici?
J'y crois pas trop, donc.
Et on retrouve les cordes à jeunes en terre sauvage, là, là-bas.
Tu m'as suivi ou quoi?
Peut-être. Tu viens?
That was Falcon Lake. I actually haven't seen this one. So Jordan, please tell me what it's about.
Yeah, I actually first saw this last year at the Cannes Film Festival, where it premiered in the director's Fortnight strand. It is the directorial debut of French-Canadian actor Charlotte Le Bon, who you'll probably know best as one of the co-stars of The Walk with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Yeah. And she has a brief role in Fresh from last year. It's actually an adaptation of a French graphic novel called A Sister. But it's about a 13-year-old boy called Bastien, played by Joseph Engel. And it's the story of his sort of summer dalliance slash first love experience with a 16-year-old family friend called Chloe, played by Sarah Montpetit. Their parents are sort of old friends, so their two families spend their family holidays together at a cabin by Falcon Lake, which is this imposing lake in Manitoba, Canada, where Charlotte Le Bon actually grew up. Bastien, of course, as a 13-year-old boy about to turn 14, as he is at pains to point out every time that his age is mentioned, he's immediately smitten with Chloe, who he hasn't seen in a number of years. And she is obviously grown up in that time. She's older, she's cooler. She's this young woman who drinks and smokes and knows a great deal about the world, certainly much more than he seems to. And Chloe, for her part, sees something in Bastien as well. She's recently broken up with her boyfriend, so that has perhaps affected her decision-making. But there's something about Bastien's innocence and his good nature that she seems to be drawn to after being treated terribly by all the older boys that she generally hangs around with. So they essentially spend their summer holidays together, growing closer together. They go to the lake together. They go to parties and dance. Most importantly, they share their kind of deepest fears and concerns with each other in a way that I just found really endearing and quite sweet. So in some ways, it kind of follows that coming of age first love template pretty much to the letter. But one of the things that I really liked about it is that it's also sort of a ghost story. Mm. Because Chloe is this sort of slightly morbid character who has a fascination with the fact that someone apparently drowned on this lake in a previous summer. And she's constantly talking about the fact that there might be a dead body in this lake. She's putting sheets over her head and pretending to be the ghost of this person in the distance and getting Bastien to take pictures of her and lying in the middle of the road, pretending to be a dead body, all these kind of things. So the whole film has this slightly spooky quality where it feels like there's just the threat of death hanging over it at all times. And I don't think I'd ever seen like quite that contrast in a film like this before, where it's just, it's a very just sweet coming of age, but then at the same time, you have this very dark undercurrent running through the whole thing as well. The film is shot on 16mm, so on actual film, in Academy aspect ratio, so that kind of square boxy aspect ratio. The cinematography is absolutely gorgeous. I think it's a stunningly beautiful film. The way it looks really evokes like the celluloid pictures, like old photo book pictures that you might have of your own family holidays from, you know, your childhood trips to lakes or center parks or wherever you may have gone as a kid. And I thought that was a really smart, really effective choice, because it just instantly invokes this nostalgic quality where you, you know, you transplant your own memories of your own childhood holidays onto this film as well. And I absolutely love this film. I'm semi-baffled why it seems to be going so far under the radar for most people. It barely got noticed out of Cannes. Criminally, it's only getting a digital release in the UK. It's not even going into cinemas, which is a real shame because it's one of the best looking films I saw at the whole Cannes Film Festival last year. And it's definitely one of the best looking films I've seen this year. I love the main characters, the young actors. I hadn't seen them, either of them, in anything before. I thought they were both super engaging as screen presences. The fact that they are this age mismatched couple, you know, she is 3 years older than the boy, may set a few alarm bells ringing, but I would say that this is in no way salacious or trying to be controversial. It's just trying to be a very sweet romance. And I actually like the fact that it shows those young relationships as silly and fun, which is something that you often don't get in films like this, where they're just a bit too self-serious and sincere. Like, this actually gets that when you're that age, kissing girls and maybe going further is just, you feel quite embarrassed by it. And it's just something that you end up laughing about more than anything else. I actually really, really love this. I've watched it a few times now, and just to make sure that I wasn't like, don't know, on some kind of Cannes trip where I was just so deep in like the Romanian new wave and depressing films that this was just a refresh, like a breath of fresh air at the time. But no, I think this is genuinely great. It's one of my favorite films this year. I can't wait to show it to more people because I think it's really wonderful. And I would highly suggest that you seek it out.
I mean, this sounds incredibly up my street. So I'm sort of gutted I didn't get a chance to watch it before this episode, actually. But I will most definitely be checking it out.
Yeah, I think you would really like it. Yeah, I think you would get on with it. I actually see a little bit of you in Bastion. I think there's definitely a little bit of Matt Matum in him. Okay. I could imagine that's what you were like as a young man.
I'm going to approach you with a lot more caution now.
But no, I would say like Charlotte Le Bon, like just such a really impressive debut. I'd say like she's an actress who like she's always done sort of solid work, but she's someone who's never really had that sort of breakthrough moment like as an actor.
Yeah.
Obviously, she was a model as well. She's a strikingly beautiful woman. But as a writer and director, I think she may have found her calling here. Like, I think I haven't actually read the original graphic novel that it's based on, but it feels so cinematic, like as a piece of storytelling. And then her direction as well is just so good. There's a party scene in the middle of it, which, you know, on the surface is just like a typical teenagers getting drunk, listening to loud music kind of thing. But it just does a really effective job of putting you in Bastien's shoes at that moment. And it's just euphoric by the end of that scene. I was just so happy by the end of it. She shoots it just incredibly well, really well performed. Yeah. And the fact that there is this ghost story element going on at the same time gives it a unique flavor that I don't think anyone has quite done in this way before.
Awesome. I can't wait to actually check it out myself. And that was Falcon Lake. And if you want to watch that, it's available on digital platforms from the 10th of April. So now time for the final film. And if you're looking for a bit of Easter holidays escape, could it be this?
Ah, you will be working for the most innovative company in history.
We control their gut instincts.
We arrange coincidences.
Is that what you do here? Make people fall in love?
Oh, thank you so much.
That's why she's in our fast track program, and you, Paul, are not.
Has lost something immeasurably valuable.
It's one of the most powerful and coveted items ever to exist.
Found you.
So that was The Portable Door. Jordan, you haven't seen this yet, have you?
I haven't, unfortunately. What's it about, Matt?
I will dive in and tell you. As you might have gathered, if you've seen any sort of posters for it about, there's a giant one just down the road from me. So I kind of walk past it most mornings, but it's sort of a fantasy adventure in the vague spirit of something like Harry Potter. It's actually an Australian film and it's directed by Geoffrey Walker and it's coming out over here on Sky Cinema. And it's based on a series of books, which I'm not familiar with. It's Tom Holt's J.W. Wells and Co. series. It's basically about this youngish guy, Paul Carpenter, played by Patrick Gibson, who I've seen a few films that I know he's in, but I couldn't really, you know, kind of place him from anything. And maybe that's partly because he sort of looks like a long lost Weasley brother, presumably sort of intentionally. But he's kind of, you know, he's not in a great place. He's looking for a job. And then he misses an interview, and then he ends up in this kind of mysterious, you know, back office of this firm that he kind of can't work out what they actually do. When he gets in there, there's a young woman called Sophie, played by Sophie Wilde. And she's in there waiting for an interview. She kind of seems to know what she's there for. He has no idea what's there. And these kind of eccentric characters come out, including Sam Neill's Dennis Tanner, the CEO Humphrey Wells, who's played by Christoph Waltz. Paul has this sort of strange interview experience, doesn't really know what's going on, then comes away, and then he gets this sort of magical letter delivered to his door by a mysterious kind of clawed hand, basically saying, you know, well done, you got the job, you start tomorrow. So then he obviously goes back, and then from there, we learn more about this mysterious company that he's becoming a part of. And it's very, very much trying to be in the Harry Potter vein. It feels like that in terms of the production values, that old retro-y looking office, everyone's sitting in rows, everyone has the same hairstyle depending on what department they work on. There's kind of, you know, mysterious basements with lots of sort of fantastical paraphernalia in them. And he ends up being tasked by Waltz's Humphrey Wells with looking for this mysterious portable door that's gone missing, because it seems like he may have a kind of skill that helps him be able to kind of locate things like that. And Sophie also has a kind of skills of her own, and it kind of goes on from there, and you kind of learn more about the world. Those two sort of, you know, develop a sort of relationship and a friendship. Yeah. And it sort of goes on from there, really. And there's goblins involved. There's, you know, portals to different places. Yeah. There's also an aspect of the Adjustment Bureau about it, if you remember that film, because there's an aspect where this company kind of control people's gut instincts, and they kind of, you know, that they're sort of seem to be behind a lot of the things, and they can make people fall in love, make them kind of discover things or invent things. They can give them a little push. And yeah, and then basically that's the film, and we sort of follow along with Paul and Sophie as they're kind of like learning more about this company and their place in it, and what might really be going on after hours there.
Any good?
I went in with sort of, you know, lowish expectations. It was fine. It was the main word I'd probably use is underwhelming, which obviously isn't really a great word. I sort of warmed to it a bit more as it went along. It does feel a bit sort of cheap. It doesn't feel like it has quite those Harry Potter production values that it sort of aims for. And I even just couldn't help thinking the name Paul Carpenter. It just feels like a sort of like ersatz, like Harry Potter. But yeah. At the same time, you know, I wasn't bored by it. Like, you know, Sam Neill's always kind of enjoyable. There was enough to kind of like, there's enough to keep you sort of interested. Like Rachel House is in it as well. Miranda Otto, they're kind of people, you know, on the board of this company. So there's sort of, you know, a bit of fun to be had there. It was just perfectly fine. It was sort of inoffensive if you were sort of forced to sit in front of it. But at the same time, I wouldn't give it a sort of hard recommend, you know, like it just feels like, you know, a bit of throwaway fantasy that's never going to sort of find the audience of something like Harry Potter.
I'm guessing there's not going to be a franchise to follow from this.
Yeah, I'd be surprised. There's kind of hints of where it could go. What film doesn't kind of have those these days? But yeah, it doesn't feel like one that people will be sort of screaming for more with. But yeah, underwhelming was my main sort of takeaway.
All right, for sticking the kids in front of over the Easter weekend if you're desperate for a break,
and if you've already seen Mario. So if you do fancy checking that out, that's The Portable Door, which is available on Sky Cinema from Friday. We're nearly at the end now. So what was your film of the week this week, Jordan? I think I can probably guess.
Yeah, 100% Falcon Lake. Just a real gem that seems to be going largely unnoticed. So please do check it out. But I would say the Super Mario Brothers movie, perfectly fine, perfectly enjoyable. I don't think you'll be disappointed if you go to the cinema to see that.
Oh yeah, I agree with that on Mario. Probably Lola would probably just sort of edge it for me in terms of being the more interesting film. But, you know, Mario equally just, you know, an enjoyable sort of fun cinema experience. But yeah, I'll pick Lola this week. By the sounds of it, Falcon Lake might be my film of the week once I actually get around to watching it. And just a reminder that if you do like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just like and subscribe now and you're all set and you'll never miss a future episode. And before we go, I should also mention that we still have our latest issue is on sale, featuring Fast X on the cover, which Jordan himself did the interviews and feature for.
Oh yeah, really good chats with Vin Diesel, Jason Momoa, Brie Larson, both newcomers to the Fast series, of course, and Louis Leterrier, the director. There's an incredible account of how he became the director of Fast X with literally 4 days notice after Justin Lin quit during the first week of filmmaking, which sort of has to be read to be believed, really, because it's just wild that someone could find themselves directing a $300 million film with like 4 days notice. I just don't understand how that works, but I did after I spoke to Louis, so you can read about it in the issue.
It is a truly insane story, and one that makes me think I'll never complain about being stressed at work ever again after reading that.
Exactly.
And also relevant to what we were discussing earlier, there's an interview with Steven Yeun in there by Anne Lee, you know, kind of tied to Beef and Beyond.
Yep, great read.
And then there's a retro piece on the Super Mario Brothers 1993 movie from with the directors that, again, really another insane behind the scenes story. And then there's just loads more as well, like John Boyega, Peter Pan and Wendy, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, Citadel, which is the Russo Brothers' new sort of Spyverse TV show. So loads of good stuff in there, which is out now with that Fast X cover. So that's all we have time for this week. But next week, we'll be back with Nicholas Hoult to discuss his new film, Renfield. And we'll review that, plus Suzumi and the Cairo Conspiracy. So join us then, or just, you know, subscribe so you'll just get that one automatically anyway. And before we go, we just have time for one last listener's question, which is, what film news broadcast from the future would you like to see?
I mean, the possibilities are endless, but there's really only one option for me, which is the news that John Carpenter has returned and made another five-star masterpiece. That's the only news broadcast I need from the future. Imagine that. Imagine how much that would blow your mind, just not knowing when it's coming or what it's going to be about. That'd be incredible. Just knowing that the master had one more great film left in him.
That would be amazing. And for me, as a kind of Dark Knight trilogy obsessive, I would love to get a broadcast saying that Nolan and Bale have kind of re-teamed sort of in 20 or 30 years time to sort of bring their Batman out of retirement for one last mission when he's like, you know, Batman's, you know, at least 70 or something. Like,
do like Dark Knight Returns or something with an old man Batman. You gotta hope that's like a long-term plan of theirs. Can you imagine?
I think the anticipation would just kill me, really. I think if I got that broadcast. Yeah. I just don't think I'd have to find some way to kind of hack Lola to sort of get the full film back for me.
We need to create, because Lola, obviously very low resolution, very poor quality. We need to like create a Lola that's like crystal clear 4K, like HDR.
The IMAX Lola.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to stream films from the future. How great would that be?
I mean, I will buy a ticket when it comes out as well.
Yeah, so okay. I'll buy the Blu-ray as well, or the, I don't know, the direct broadcast into your brain, whatever it is that, however we're watching films in 30 years time.
Well, on that note, it's time for us to say goodbye and send this broadcast out. So, Jordan, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.